Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, July 26th. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. He's been in the news for various reasons since taking office in January. We'll talk about several of them. Today, it's for the exoneration of a 48-year-old man you might call the sixth member of the Central Park Five. Like Corey Wise, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Antron McRae, and Yousef Salaam, Stephen Lopez was charged in the 1989 rape and beating of a white female jogger in Central Park. The other five were tried and convicted, served years in prison, and were later exonerated by Manhattan DA Robert Morgenthau, who had charged them in the first place. They also received a total of $41 million in settlements from the city of New York. Stephen Lopez was also charged with rape in that case, but never went to trial because he reached a plea bargain, guilty to robbing a different jogger, a male, and the rape charge was dropped. Lopez never appealed his conviction and only last year asked that it be revisited. Now the DA's office has vacated that conviction too after newly reviewing the evidence. The exonerated five are now the exonerated six. Of course, D.A. Bragg has also been in the news for charging, then dropping the charges against bodega worker Jose Alba, who fatally stabbed a man caught on video attacking him. Also for not pursuing a criminal case that had potentially been in the works against Donald Trump. And Bragg has been in the news as the symbol for the political right, at very least, of a progressive prosecutor movement that has gone too far in a time of high crime rates. Republican gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin even says that if elected, he would fire Bragg, despite Bragg being elected by the people of Manhattan. D.A. Bragg, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me again.
In the case of the Central Park Five, someone else confessed to the rape and his DNA confirmed it. How did you figure out after all these years that Stephen Lopez didn't even rob the male jogger who he pleaded guilty to robbing?
Well, you know, we did as we do in all of our investigations. We looked at the evidence. So we looked, and as I said in court yesterday, really at a couple of key pieces. You know, one, there had been some hair sample comparisons tying allegedly Mr. Lopez to the charged conduct, and you know, those have been deemed unreliable. And so there's no physical evidence connecting Mr. Lopez to the charged conduct. And then, as I think many people know from the five who were had their convictions vacated before yesterday, much, if not almost all of the evidence was based on statements by other young men, extraordinarily young men, I should say boys, at the time. And those statements have all been recanted. There was internal inconsistencies. And so it really grows from the same analysis that applied to the other five. No physical evidence, no reliable statements, and so it was certainly in my view and in the court's view time to take this step, and I was humbled to be a part of it.
You say boys. I think Lopez was 15, and I saw that you mentioned personally identifying with all the defendants from that case because you were a black kid around the same age, also from around there. Can you talk about how this hits you personally?
Certainly. I mean, so, first and foremost, the matters about Mr. Lopez and the impact on his life and, his incarceration and the collateral consequences that flow from that. But certainly, as someone who grew up in Central Harlem, as someone who went past Central Park every day to go to and from school, this case, I think, as for many, cast a long shadow over the criminal justice system. So certainly something that I've, long been familiar with, and I think in many ways has sort of, affected me as it did, I think, a generation of people and their perception of things that can happen. So it is, as I said, first and foremost about Mr. Lopez. He was the one who was incarcerated and had the consequences. But I think there are broader messages here. And that's a big part of our post-conviction justice unit is to take the lessons and apply them forward.
The guy who really attacked The woman jogger, Patricia Maley, later confessed, and it was corroborated by DNA evidence. Do you have an alternative suspect in the robbery of the male jogger?
There are, and you're right on as to that, and that was sort of, you know, a big part of the reinvestigation in 2002. There are other people who were, and in fact, one person who was connected to and served time in connection. So we focused on these six because they were charged with the rape. There were others who were charged with other matters, and they were not affected by yesterday's vacator.
Does this case suggest to you that the focus on wrongful conviction that we associate with Central Park Five should be accompanied by a focus on false confession? And I mean a larger focus in society. You know, people know the Innocence Project and things like that. The focus primarily on wrongful convictions. How about wrongful confessions?
No, I think wrongful confessions are a very significant piece of this. You know, they were, as I said, kind of the false statements. And people say, well, how can you, you know, if someone says they did it, they must have done it. And you noted the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project and others, it's a growing and vast, you know, body of research on false statements. What I would actually draw people's attention to here is, as to the other five, there were false statements implicating each other and others. Here, we have a plea, so someone who pled guilty. And so something that I think that there's some scholarly research on and we need to think about is our look backs, not just involving things that ended in a conviction by trial, but also extending to and looking at convictions by plea as we did yesterday.
D.A. Bragg, let me ask you next about the charges you also dropped against Hamilton Heights bodega worker Jose Alba. Some people have asked, after seeing the surveillance video of that incident on TV or on the web, how did you even get so far as to charge him with murder in the first place, because it looked so clearly like a case of self-defense? So can you take us through some of the sequence of events from the standpoint of your office's investigation?
So, you know, we filed a motion to dismiss, which kind of sets forth you know, our reasoning. And so, you know, I tend to speak in court as to specific cases, but I can talk generally about the process of a case, right? So, you know, the process is many of our cases begin with an NYPD arrest, as that one did. And certainly I think most people expect when there's someone who's, you know, dead, and then someone who is taking an act to cause that death, that person be arrested. That happened here. And then the person then goes before a judge. The next step, if the case is going to go forward, is a case like that, a presentation to a grand jury. In between that period, my office's work and our obligation and my commitment to the people of Manhattan is that we're always going to do a thorough, independent, fact-finding investigation. And I know, you know, people want that to go faster, and there was commentary and there were, you know, news articles, but our job here is to focus on the evidence. And that's what the career prosecutors did here. And then when we arrived at, based on the evidence, a conclusion, we filed a motion in court explaining that to the public. And so that's our commitment. You know, when there's an arrest by the NYPD, you know, for a death in Manhattan, we are going to investigate that thoroughly and independently and arrive at a conclusion based on the evidence.
Critics of New York's bail reform law have contrasted the Jose Alba case with the one against the man who allegedly attacked Republican gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin, was some kind of appointed object during a campaign speech upstate the other day. This is not about you, I should say to our listeners, because that wasn't in Manhattan, so it's not your jurisdiction. But that guy was only charged with second-degree attempted assault, which meant he could not be required to pay bail or be jailed awaiting trial. But he was trying to attack, maybe assassinate, a candidate for governor in our democracy, allegedly. So some people see the system as really inverted. When Jose Alba had to go through what he went through, and the other guy cannot even be required to post bail under New York's recent law, does it make sense to you?
Well, you know, I'm certainly not going to comment on another, I mean, at this point, ongoing federal investigation. You know, as a former federal prosecutor, and actually used the statute that I assume is being used there, but not going to comment on that. But I will, I think, underscore what I think is the glaring difference, which is that, you know, in the Manhattan case, there was someone who was dead. And, you know, obviously our system, you know, looks to, you know, harm, and the ultimate harm is obviously death. So without commenting on the specifics there, I do think that's a noteworthy distinction.
Yeah, although the guy who's been charged federally with plotting to kill Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court justice, he didn't get to do it either, but I think he's been charged with something much more serious. What do you think about that as a comparison?
You know, so again, I don't know the proof in those matters. And again, as I said, you know, as a federal prosecutor and familiar with the conspiracy laws and, you know, what your intent is. And so having an intent to kill, if in fact that is the evidence, there is obviously also, you know, very, very serious. I don't mean to, you know, kind of suggest that the other harms in these matters not significant, but I do think it is worth noting and unscoring that in the alma mater, there was, you know, someone who was, when the time the NYPD arrested, made the arrest for murder, there was quite literally a dead person, and that's an undisputable fact, and I think a significant one.
This goes back to the vacating of the charges against Stephen Lopez, the so-called sixth member of the Central Park Five, and it's Ben in Belmore. You're on WNYC with Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. Hi, Ben.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask a question in terms of when you vacate this plea, what happens to the attorney that's representing them? Because they make some affirmations and they make representations that their representation was sound and they're happy with it before taking any kind of plea. So then is there a ground to charge the representing attorney? Surely there's some, you know, somebody representing them, whether it's legal aid or private counsel.
Thanks, Ben, for the question. And I take it to refer to not Mr. Lopez's current lawyer, but his lawyer, back when the plea was entered. You know, certainly when we do these kind of reinvestigations, we're looking at and talking to sort of all of the witnesses. I think suffice it to say, without getting into sort of the details of this matter, I think there were a lot of things that happened at that moment that we now know to be different over the passage of time and reinvestigation that were not known then. So, you know, the hair sample comparisons, later being deemed unreliable, resulting in no physical evidence being there, the statements that were, you know, made at the time that were then later recanted. I think this is certainly a fair question. And I think one that we need to be thinking about when we think about wrongful convictions. We have lots of inputs that lead to them, false confections, not in this case, but often, faulty witness and identification, unreliable evidence. And one of those can sometimes be inadequate assistance of counsel by a defense lawyer. I'm not saying that happened here, because as I said, we sort of had, you know, circumstances that changed. But as a general matter, I do hear your question and think it's something that as we go forward and apply the lessons forward is one of the things that the research says we should be taking a look at and take into consideration.
Lily in Manhattan has a phone call. Lily, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling the Manhattan DA.
Yes, hello. I have worked as a social worker, so I know a thing or two about social problems. Let me be very clear. Mr. Bragg knows nothing about anything. I have never heard him.
Do you think that's a little broad, Lily? Do you have a specific question?
My specific point is everyone knows that crime is on the rise because the criminals know that the DA won't lock them up. Bragg should be recalled. He never discusses public safety. His job is public safety. He is not doing his job. We, the taxpayers, are paying you. We're all for looking at people who were convicted wrongly. We're all for that. But you are also responsible for public safety. I have never heard you mention public safety. You belong in the Legal Aid Society or the Fortune Society. You do not behave like a district attorney, and you should be recalled. You are letting down the people of this city. And I'm sure you know that the victims are from all races.
Lily, thank you for your call. So let me turn that into a question, D.A. Bragg. I mean, the overall impression that your critics have, as I think was articulated this, you know, right there, you're passionate, as you've noted, about exonerating the wrongfully convicted. Are you as passionate about getting violent criminals off the street?
Well, and let me be clear and unequivocal about this, Brian. I have served as a federal prosecutor. I've served as a line state prosecutor in court. I served as the number two prosecutor for the state of New York, the Attorney General's office. So I've spent a career doing this, and that involves cases from, you know, armed robbery to cases involving sex offenses to public corruption. I've been doing that, and we're doing that every day in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. So let me just start with some, you know, facts. And I appreciate Lily's point, and perhaps I'm not talking about it enough, so let me use some time to talk about it now. Homicides are down 6% in Manhattan. Homicides are down citywide as well, but importantly in Manhattan they're down. And shootings are down in Manhattan 12.8%. We certainly have a lot more work to do, but I think those are statistics that are trending in the right direction. And how do we get there? We got there through very hard work by career prosecutors in the office. And so I think the number one issue facing the island is gun crimes. You know, year to date, we brought 360 gun cases. That's up significantly from last year. Now, that's tragic that the number is up, that the cases are there to be prosecuted, but we're doing the work. You know, I, like other New Yorkers, are concerned about our transit system and our train safety. You know, we've had some significant trials this year holding people accountable for doing violence on our trains. And so I take Lily's point. I'm a prosecutor by trade and not an elected, not a politician. And so we are leaning into and making clear that the public is knowing that we're doing these things. I mean, the person who did the triple stabbing on the subway was, you know, convicted at trial and now has a 14-year prison sentence. We did three very significant gun trafficking cases that are in the process of being litigated with guns flooding here from down south in North Carolina and ghost gun parts coming from Pennsylvania. So the work is happening every single day. And so I'm happy that Lily asked that question or made that statement to give me the opportunity to really underscore that people know what we're doing to keep Manhattan safe.
And since you made the distinction between commercial robbery at knife point, which that example was about, and how you approach guns, one other example, Gotham has said, you know, in relation to the original memo and then a change, Braga also clarified his stance on gun prosecution, saying the default in gun cases is a felony prosecution. Now, as I recall, you had said on this show after your election that there should be a difference between people who simply own a gun illegally and are caught with it and those who use it in a crime. So where are you on that now?
Well, I mean, look, I think certainly there is a difference in terms of the what we can charge and in terms of the penalty. And it kind of goes back to your comparison of the case in Rochester. The harm matters. And so, you know, we are certainly prioritizing shooting cases, homicide cases, and I think that's why you see those numbers coming down. But we're also are doing the gun possession cases. Like I said, we've got about 360 cases that we've done so far. So I do think the trafficking cases that I mentioned when we're dealing with guns coming in from North Carolina and Pennsylvania, the cases where, you know, someone's least in one of those cases are selling 20 guns at a time, I think that is different from someone who's carrying one gun, and we're treating them differently, and I think that's appropriate.
Lee Zeldin, as I mentioned, is campaigning around the state on a plan to fire you if he's elected governor, even though you were elected by the people of Manhattan alone. Do you have any comment on what the law would even allow in that regard, or about him making you the face of unseriousness about crime in New York in the way that he is as a political candidate?
I'm going to let those on the ballot do their political campaigns, and we're going to focus on the work of keeping Manhattanites safe.
George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with DA Alvin Bragg. Hi, George.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for letting me on. My question is about a possible prosecution of Mr. Trump. Your predecessor had a specialized counsel brought in to do it. When you came in, at some point, somebody made the decision that either there was insufficient evidence or the inability to turn a key witness. And we've heard very little since then. So I would think that it's still pending. It has not been dropped, at least not officially. But could you bring us up to date on what, if possible, might happen in terms of the prosecutor's office looking into issues that were brought up?
Sure. I mean, just in the instance of the Alba matter, where we weren't talking about it during the pendency of it, I have the same kind of legal ethics constraints, which are basically you could impair the investigation. But I do appreciate the question and can say that we have an incredibly talented team that is still working on the investigation. The investigation is open and active and in very good hands in terms of, you know, career prosecutors who've built complicated, complex cases. And what we have said is that, you know, when we resolve the investigation, we will make that public. So that you're right. And I think the way you phrased it, George, was perfect, which is that the investigation is ongoing and people should assume that and know that. And at the moment, it is not, much like we were public in resolving the Alba matter, that we will be public and when we go forward, and however that may be, whether that's with a charge or without a charge, we will let the public know. As I said, in the Alba context, I think that's important.
So you're saying this is an ongoing investigation. I think people who've been following it in the news may have the impression that it's already been dropped, these financial crimes that may have been committed by Trump that your predecessor, D.A. Cy Vance, had been investigating. I mean, it's been in the press that the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization was charged by Vance, and it's been in the news that several top prosecutors in your office resigned because they thought you were being too cautious in not pursuing that case further against Trump himself in the way that they wanted. They seemed to believe Trump committed fraud by obtaining loans from banks based on false information. So you're saying that investigation is ongoing. What would it take, or when might the public expect that you would have a resolution one way or another of whether to charge?
Sure. Well, first, I think you were making reference to Alan Weisselberg, and that's a matter that's a charged, that's not just an active investigation, that's an active matter that's in pretrial litigation, and we anticipate, you know, would move to trial in the fall. So that would be obviously very, very public. That's a matter that's right, that's going forward, and that's, you know, unequivocally so. And in terms of what we're doing, I don't want to describe it, but suffice it to say that, you know, there are a number of avenues that were not explored before that we are exploring that I think is important. And I would, you know, just draw your attention to, as you point to others, you know, look, I'm someone who's got a 20-year history of doing complex white-collar investigations, doing investigations involving high-profile people, whether that's, you know, suing, you know, the Trump Foundation and leading that work at the AG's office, whether it's helping lead the prosecution against Malcolm Smith, the former Senate Majority Leader, you know, any one of a number of kind of high-profile white-collar investigations. So, you know, that's me, and then I could also go down the line in terms of the team of who's working on it now. You know, it's an extraordinary team of very capable prosecutors, and I can't put a timeline on it because that would be inappropriate, but I can certainly say that we're actively working and that there is a public matter that's already been charged that I think we anticipate will be tried in the fall.
Appreciate you having this conversation with us. Thank you, D.A. Alvin Bragg. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.